Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm delighted to have with me in the studio today Dr. Marcello Sorcichella. Dr. Keller was born in Milan in Italy, and he made his home for some years in the US, about 10 years. But he says he feels equally at home in Italy and also in Switzerland. He obtained a degree in sociology from the University of Milan, a degree in composition from the Milan Conservatory, and a PhD in musicology from the University of Illinois. He's always been interested in music and tries to pass on his passion to others. He's taught in the United States and also in Italy and in Switzerland. And over these last years, he's been dealing mostly with opera musical aesthetics, popular song and traditional music of various places. And he says he's usually referred to as an ethnomusicologist, and we can discuss that expression later. However, he says on his website that he would prefer to be considered, like people used to say in the Middle Ages, a musicus, because of his efforts to understand music, and a cantor, because he also enjoys making it. Dr. Keller likes to play some of his musical instruments, the ones he owns, and he composes what he calls frivolous music, but I'm sure it's delightful. And he likes to study and write about musical questions that he finds interesting. He's obviously published articles and essays and reviews in musicological journals and contributes to reference works. He's also author of Musica e Sociologia, published by Ricordi in 1997. He lives on the outskirts of Lugano, Switzerland, and also, fortunately for us, he lives in Malta. Welcome to you, Dr. Keller.
Thank you very much, Tricia. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Over the past few months, I gather that you've been developing what you describe as an interesting relationship with this university. You now sit on the board of the Mediterranean Institute and also our visiting professor. You're lecturing some courses. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about your relationship with the University of Malta.
Yes, I'd be glad to. It all happened by sheer serendipity. I was in Malta once just as a tourist, out of curiosity. I never visited this country. And as I often do when I visit a country I don't know, I try to get in touch with musicians, people who are more or less in my trade. And so I did in Malta, and some of these people I met work at the university. Some of them introduced me to some other people. And as it turns out, here at the University of Malta, something exists that very much coincides with my main interests. What I find fascinating about it is that here you have a Mediterranean Institute, which, parentheses, you know, unlike other Mediterranean institutes, you would be surprised how many Mediterranean centers, institutes, there are across the planet, one even in Melbourne, of all places. But unlike others, this institute is an academic structure within which both music, anthropology, geography, and history are taught. Subjects, areas of intellectual endeavor that indeed I believe belong together. So that I thought was lovely and very promising. So as it turns out, after I visited Malta a few other times, I came back to this lovely country, and my friendship and relationship with the people, music people mostly, teaching at the Mediterranean Institute has developed. And so I happen to be here once again teaching a course on music aesthetics, which is something that apparently they didn't have, so it sort of fills a gap in the curriculum. And I'm delighted to be able to have this experience.
In fact, I'm not sure that if somebody asked me what musical aesthetics, what a course in musical aesthetics would be all about, I'm not sure I could really answer them. Perhaps you could give an outline of what you normally put across to your students in the course.
Yes, definitely. I think I can say it in a few words. Aesthetics is that branch of philosophy interested in art. So musical aesthetics is this course about music. What I usually feel it's worth conveying to music students is is that music is such a complex, wonderful phenomenon that it deserves to become the object of intellectual observations, of intellectual discourse. Most of all, once students develop students of practical music making, you know, pianists, composers, trumpet players, once they develop this attitude of thinking about music, not just about playing it, well, they, little by little, they are bound to become aware of why do they like some kinds of music and not others. Of course, there is, as you easily can imagine, different possible standards one can apply to musical phenomena. And depending on what standard you apply, your evaluation, your judgment is going to be different. And since I belong, you mentioned it while introducing me, to a special republic within the larger area of musical studies, pompously called ethnomusicology, which is by and large the anthropology of music. When I speak about music aesthetics or anything else related to music, I like to bring to the discussion information, experiences that I collected in other musical cultures than the Western, because they provide us with fascinating points of view and fascinating insights that within our narrower world we wouldn't be able to catch, to notice, to experience.
Yes, well, sounds fascinating. I think I'll come and sit in on your lectures if you don't mind.
You're very welcome.
Well, aesthetics, of course, is always a bit of a minefield, really. If you're normally, I would think of aesthetics as you say, in the artistic, more other artistic forms, and the discourse is always a little bit problematic. But as you say, bringing in the importance of bringing in other cultures, of course, is very important, especially for university students who perhaps have not had opportunities to be in contact with other cultures than our own sort of Western tradition, really. And you've said that ethnomusicology is a rather pompous expression, but in fact, it's become rather a sort of a buzzword, actually, sort of the ethno idea. And you sort of translate that through, you sort of use the expression through music. So you're interested in other cultures, also other ways of playing music, other instruments. You say you've got some interesting instruments of your own. Have you collected them from around the world?
I'm not really a collector, but whenever I find an instrument that looks especially attractive, if I have the money, I buy it. Because, you know, musical instruments are instruments that help you make music. They're very often also beautiful objects. They have a charm, they are something aesthetic about them, too. And very often instrument makers pay attention to that, too. You may even find instruments that are more beautiful than they sound sometimes.
We have, actually, in these last years, with certain people like Ruben Zara and people who have taken a great interest, an intellectual interest, not just a sort of a musical playing interest in ethnographic music of Malta. Have you got involved at all in our local ethno music scene at all?
Not much here in Malta, but even though this is something I would like to get into as soon as I the opportunity comes by, but I do know something about Maltese musical traditions, because, and this is the peculiar thing, you see, I believe in the inevitability of chance. Things happen that one couldn't possibly predict or even imagine. I was once in Australia pursuing some research. I was focusing on immigrant groups of Mediterranean origin, but not the Maltese, really. I started with the Italians, the Greeks, and other national groups. But then I did meet some people originally from Malta, and I heard interesting things from them. I heard, for instance, that they were reviving a particular kind of singing, a particular kind of song that at the time was totally new to me, Ana Spirtu Pront. They were reviving it in Australia. So to make a long story short, I got interested in them. I thought to myself immediately, sooner or later I will have to get to know Malta, the country they come from. And while in Australia, by contacting a few other Maltese or people who were married to a Maltese, I discovered that a few dissertations had been written on Maltese music in Australia, and also that at the Australian National Library, which has a national archive, a sound archive, some wonderful recordings exist of Maltese traditional singing collected in Australia, yes, in Australia, and there are wonderful recordings both in terms of the performance and the quality of the recording that was made professionally. So,
So you're going to be working on that, you're going to be researching that yourself? Or?
The first thing I would like to do is to put together in an edited book all contributions that have been written, all these short dissertations. They're usually master's thesis on Maltese music collected in Australia. There's a few of them already, and I think they would deserve to be known, and therefore I contacted an Australian publisher, trying to convince the publishing house that it would be wonderful, and it would be the first time a publisher does it, to open a series of books devoted to Italian music in Australia, Maltese music in Australia, Chinese music in Australia, and so on and so forth. For commercial reasons, they decided that they should begin with Italian music in Australia.
It's a wider
market, right?
Although the number of Maltese in Australia
is
quite
remarkable,
large.
It's remarkable.
The diaspora is really big.
It's gauged to be, there might be as many Maltese in Australia as there are in Malta, almost.
Probably more.
Probably more.
We're only 400,000 here.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to imagine that these people who will have emigrated from Malta in the 50s and the early 60s, when perhaps the Spirtu Pront tradition was still quite felt in certain areas of Malta, and they would have taken that with them. And there's, when you emigrate, obviously there's the risk of losing, but there's also the positive side that there are people who will want to hang on to what they remember.
Yeah. You find a variety of, how can I put it, reactions to the experience of migration. And among many, the two you mentioned. Memory and traditions may get lost, especially so when there is a good reason to forget. You know, people who come like migrants used to be a long time ago at the beginning of the 20th century, people who were leaving Europe, abandoning a life of poverty, a miserable kind of life, and landed in Australia, the United States, or Canada, or wherever, they often did just wanted to forget songs and traditions that reminded them of the life that they had fortunately put behind. So that can happen. It can also happen the contrary, what anthropologists call marginal survival. Whenever immigrant groups are capable of reconstituting, rebuilding some kind of a homogeneous group, in that case, their traditions are likely to be preserved, like in the Little Italies of the United States, like in the Chinese neighborhoods, Chinatowns. Traditions are likely to be preserved sometimes in a sort of a frozen state.
Time warp.
Exactly. To the point that, if today you were interested in studying traditional Chinese music, and you were interested in finding the older layers of that tradition, you should better look for them in Australia than in China. The same applies to language, dialects, phonetics. I give you an example. Few people know that in northern Italy, there is a few pockets where Germanic languages have survived. Very small pockets. For instance, in the province of Verona and Vicenza, in the Venetian plains, there is 7 and 13 townships where Cimbrian, a Germanic language, has nowadays barely survived, but up until 1960, it was much more solid, and it survived to a degree that it could be documented, that people could indeed express themselves with some sophistication in that language. Those linguistic enclaves were studied by scholars in Germanistics because they could find in those enclaves features, archaic features of the German language that had totally disappeared in Austria, Germany, and northern Switzerland. And there is a correlation between languages and musical traditions. Wherever a language survives, you might even find musical leftovers, so to say, of older days that in the land of origin have disappeared. So to bring the story to completion, just like a northern German who visits one of these villages in the province of Vicenza might be indeed surprised by what he hears, words that have changed their meaning, that he finds distorted, that he may find funny, so a Maltese might be surprised to visit Maltese people in Sydney, hear the music they make, and find that it is not exactly quite what he knows. It might be, it may sound archaic to his ears, or in a larger city like Sydney, it's more likely to happen. It may sound polluted, hybridized with other forms of music that exist in Sydney, and with which Anna singing has merged in a syncretic manner and produced something that in Malta could never have occurred.
So the development would have been completely different.
Completely. A different line of development is open over there for Maltese music, which is which is something that in Malta, of course, could not happen. So that's the fascination.
Absolutely. That sounds as though there's quite a few dissertations or books or whatever in that area. I'm sure it's got great potential.
It does.
And, of course, things probably differ even from, there's one thing talking about Melbourne and perhaps Sydney, and then perhaps another group, say in Perth or Adelaide or somewhere, might have developed things differently because they've had certain people who've gone there and this sort of thing.
It's so, quite possible. Definitely. I can imagine. Quite possible.
And you say that you're going to be with the Mediterranean Institute, you're going to be organising next year in July, and a Mediterranean ethnomusicology workshop. What is that exactly going to do? Do you know how it's going to develop that?
Yes, I do know at this point in time because July 2010 is not that far away in the future anymore. Mm-hmm. Let me explain it this way. There is a group of ethnomusicologists, a study group devoted to Mediterranean musics that has been in existence for some 15 years. I'm part of it, and at the present time I am in charge of organizing future events, that is, opportunities for these scholars to meet, exchange ideas, experiences, and discuss their Mediterranean research. I thought Malta would be a very appropriate place for us to meet next year. And at the same time, I felt like inventing something, a new format of sorts. Speaking to friends, it occurred to me that ethnomusicologists, taken as they are, by their academic careers, writing papers in order to get a promotion to associate professor or full professor. In the course of the years, they've done very little, if anything at all, for music educators. And music educators in Europe at the present time need all the help they can get, because all across Europe they find in their classrooms, people of various extractions. You go to a classroom in primary school in Switzerland and you find people who come from the Middle East or Africa. So, having someone coming from Ghana and ask him in the music education class to sing a German folk song is not necessarily the way to help this person to merge into the group, because that folk song will sound very foreign to his ears. Here, ethnomusicologists could provide information and advice to music educators. So, we are the Mediterranean Institute with me. We are also organizing, on the side of this meeting, which is a scholarly meeting with specialized people talking shop to each other, two workshops for music educators. Maltese music educators are welcome, but also we hope to have people from continental Europe. They will go through one-day workshop that will be an introduction to Mediterranean ethnomusicology, and Philip Chantara, who teaches here, will teach it. A second workshop will be taught by a brilliant Italian music educator, Elita Maule, who will explain how can one use ethnomusicology in the classroom. And once music educators have had this background, have gone through these 2 days, 2 days of workshops that should be quite enjoyable, then they will be very welcome to attend, to audit, to be present at the scholarly meeting of specialized ethnomusicologists, and some of them will be phenomenal people in their field, hear what they say, and if they feel like it, ask questions. This might, I hope, in my vision, should make ethnomusicologists sensitive by putting them in touch with music educators, opportunities to meet have seldom occurred. And we'll give the opportunity, music educators, to get to know close by, to interact with ethnomusicologists, and some exchanges between the two could be, I hope, productive. Ethnomusicologists might become sensitive to questions of music education, and music educators will learn that there is a lot of knowledge in this area of musical scholarship that they might grab and use in the classroom.
I would imagine that it's important that the one group informs the work of the other. In both directions, sort of osmosis through through both sides.
Yeah. Well, that would be really wonderful if it could happen to some degree. You are an academic yourself. You know that one of the problems in academia is that walls are built. The world is not separated in areas, disciplines, fields and subfields, reality out there, but departments are. And sometimes communication is not as effective, as direct, as in one might wish.
Yes, well, in fact, one of the joys of the institutes that we have here at the university, including very much so the Mediterranean, the idea was that there should be always this networking and information moving from one area to the other. So, well, unfortunately, our time has come to an end. Thank you very, very much, Dr.
Thank
Keller,
you very much.
For coming to talk to us today on Campus FM.
It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
My guest today was Dr. Marcello Sorgichella. I do hope that you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.